with no mattresses, just cuffed in the cells. It'll be one officer ignoring them. There was maggots all over the garbage cans. There's big water bugs, roaches and everything. They'll really just leave you in there. It's like they pay you no mind.
That was William Sanford, a 35-year-old man currently detained in New York City's Rikers Island jail facility. He spoke last week with WNYC reporter Jake Offenhartz. Now, recent visitors to Rikers have described similarly disturbing conditions. And I just want you to remember, most people in Rikers have not been convicted of a crime. They are living in these conditions while awaiting trial. New York Governor Kathy Hochul has sought to reduce the Rikers population with her recent signing of the Less is More Act, ending the policy of sending people to jail for parole violations, including marijuana use and missed curfews.
So the Board of Parole, under my direction, will have 191 people released today. They have served their sentences under the dictates of the new Less is More, but they shouldn't have to wait for the enactment date.
The nearly 200 people that the governor mentioned there had all been detained at Rikers Island. Last week, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio toured Rikers, a visit he had reportedly been putting off for weeks. And in a combative press conference, the mayor declined to give specifics on the conditions he witnessed, instead repeatedly focusing on his administration's plans to close Rikers by 2027.
I'm going to tell you what I've done under my watch. I've put the plan in place to get us the hell out of here. That's the bottom line. It's a place that is structurally broken. But within that, we can make a lot of improvements in the short term. The real answer is to get off Rikers Island once and for all.
The mayor also said that recent changes to policies on Rikers are already having a, quote, real impact. But according to Alfred, another man detained at Rikers who spoke with WNYC last week, that simply hasn't been the case.
Nothing changed. They had the people, the mayor come through here, they hit the people in intake because it's two intake, it's seg intake and regular intake. They hire people in the gym, you know what I'm saying? So when people come, that like the mayor, the governor, whatever, whoever come here to see what's going on, there's nobody in intake, you know what I'm saying? Usually, but it'd be 30 people in one cell, in every cell packed. When I came through intake, it was 30 people in one cell. And I got here on a Saturday, and I didn't get to the house that I went to until Tuesday.
And the problems extend beyond Rikers. 12 people detained in New York City's jails have died this year, and at least 5 of those deaths have been suicide. Recent COVID outbreaks have led to delays in court hearings for a growing number of detainees. And as of last week, 5,600 people were being held in New York City's jails. The vast majority of them have not yet been on trial. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and today on The Takeaway, we're going to examine exactly what is going on in Rikers Island, one of the world's largest jails. And for more, I'm joined now by George Joseph, law enforcement reporter for WNYC. Thanks for coming back on the show, George.
Hi, Melissa.
Now, you've been reporting extensively on the self-harm that's been happening in New York City's jails during the pandemic. What are some of the reasons that detainees are hurting themselves?
I think it's been a really hard time for people who are incarcerated in jails across the country during this pandemic. And the reason I say that is because at the height of the pandemic, which, as you remember, hit New York City here really hard first, a lot of services were suddenly shut down. So all of a sudden, people can no longer go outside to get recreation time. They can't have visits from families. They can't access commissary to get really basic supplies like extra food. So all these extra services that people rely on to get through in jails are suddenly cut off. But what was unique in New York, especially compared to other cities across the country, is that throughout the year, we also saw a big staffing crisis, meaning hundreds to thousands of corrections officers were calling out sick or even just going AWOL, not showing up to work. And in recent months, it's built up to a crisis where the Department of Correction cannot get detainees basic services, getting them to housing units, cleaning up facilities, getting people food on time. And so this has come to a boiling point where people are so desperate in some cases, they are taking their lives.
The conditions you describe, it recalls for me that at least early on, I think most of us have moved to the language of quarantine, but there was kind of this language of lockdown, right? We're all on lockdown. And this is a reminder that while many of us may have been living under a stay-at-home order, being on actual lockdown is a different set of conditions.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that gets people through jail time the most is family visits. And that being cut off is really hard on people, especially as you mentioned at the top of the show. A lot of these people aren't necessarily used to being in jail. They're there pre-trial. They're awaiting charges. They are sort of still having a hope in their mind that they may get out, or they may beat their charges, or they may be proven innocent. So they are sort of in this moment where not only do they not have access to family or services, because of the pandemic, everything is being delayed. Court dates are being put off for weeks, months. They have no idea when they're actually even going to get their day in court because of the shutdown. So that's another psychological element where people are waiting and waiting and waiting and feeling like I'm being tortured here, but I don't even get to sort of argue my case.
Given that there have been at least 5 deaths by suicide, and given what you're saying about sort of the lack of even basic services like, trash removal and daily food on time, are there protocols in place to prevent suicides in New York jails?
So there are protocols. There are training of corrections officers, and the Department of Correction has tried to assure the public that it is doing everything possible to train people in sort of suicide prevention work. Not that guards hadn't gotten any training before, but to continue to train them. However, medical professionals that we've spoken to in the jails have argued you can't really rely on those sort of very specific trainings to stop this overall problem. By the time someone has gotten to such a point of desperation that they want to take their life, and there are many people in the jails like that, it can almost be in some cases too late because you're not going to catch and stop everyone. On top of that, you have some of these guards who are working double, triple shifts by themselves in some of these housing units. And there's a question of if they're capable of every time stopping these kinds of incidents from happening, both one, capable physically, and two, able mentally. Are they willing to go do those throat checks? Do they care enough to stop things as they're happening? Those are concerns and fears that a federal monitor that is currently sort of regulating and overseeing Rikers Island has raised in recent weeks.
Can you say more about that federal monitor? How did they get there, and what is it they're meant to be doing?
So New York City jail system has been a mess for a long time. And in recent years, a federal judge appointed a person to sort of regulate and oversee the jails. And, you know, every couple of months they put out a new report recommending changes and sort of showing progress on how the Department of Correction has been doing in terms of violence and other indicators. And, you know, a few years ago, not that jail is a good place ever, but conditions were getting somewhat better. The population was going down. You know, it looked like the city was on this path to, as Mayor de Blasio has envisioned, closing Rikers Island down and opening new community-based jails that are supposed to be better than the island right now. However, in the last year and a half since the pandemic started, the population has dramatically increased, putting those plans potentially in doubt because the closed Rikers plan relied on having a low population, and we're not seeing that right now. I mean, it's not the highest it's ever been historically, but it's much higher than the plan requires.
So let's talk about that population growth for a moment. Certainly part of it is about the pandemic and therefore the slowing of the judicial process due to COVID infections, as you pointed out, of both those who are being held as well as members of the court, sort of, you know, that's obviously created a backlog. But there's this other piece around the repeal of a certain bail reform. And I'm wondering if you can talk us through a little bit how that has also contributed to the growth of the population at Rikers.
Yeah. So like you mentioned earlier, the vast majority, almost 80% of people in Rikers Island and New York City jails are being held before a trial. So they haven't been convicted of anything. They're there for a charge that they're waiting to have adjudicated. And there are decisions that are made in court before they get to jail about whether they're going to stay in jail. And a lot of this has to do with what's known as bail. So when you first get to court, based on your charges, in New York, judges are supposed to determine whether you are a flight risk, meaning are you going to skip out on court? If you are not a flight risk, they're supposed to release you. In some cases, if you are a flight risk, they're supposed to release you sort of with supervisory conditions, or in some cases with bail. And that was sort of part of a reform that New York State passed a few years ago to try to ensure that people are being detained more because of their flight risk rather than because of how much money they had. But we've seen since sort of mid to late 2020, judges are increasingly setting bails that people can't afford more often. And that has resulted in an increase in detention. A recent study found that about 700 fewer people would be in New York City jails if judges just reverted to their behavior from early 2020. The same study found that about 1,000 people fewer would be in the city jails if judges followed the city's release recommendation, which says that when someone is statistically likely, based on an algorithm, to return to court, which is the point of bail, theoretically, you should simply release them. But what judges are doing, as we've reported right now, is assessing, well, I think this person is a potential danger to a community. If they pose sort of any risk at all, I'm going to set a bail. And because so many of our people who are in the criminal justice system are so poor, they can't afford these bails, and they end up going to places like Rikers Island, where they experience violence and in some cases take their lives.
So let's pop back for a second and talk about the mayor's visit. Clearly, we played a bit from the mayor's press conference, and he wasn't really clear about what he saw. Do you have any insight on what kinds of conditions the mayor actually observed himself?
Well, we don't exactly know what the mayor saw, because his visit was something the city was obviously aware of. They could prepare for it. They allegedly had sort of freshly painted the walls of the facility he visited. So it appears that he's got some sort of stage tour. But what we can say from having spoken to many detainees and people working in the jails right now is that over the last few weeks, the conditions have been just simply completely unsanitary. Excrement, urine all over the floors, people screaming all the time, people sort of begging staff to give them some small morsel of food. I mean, just not meeting any basic humanitarian conditions.
Isn't that a constitutional violation? I mean, we actually have documents that require, at the core of who we are as a nation, not to hold particularly American citizens, but really anyone in those kinds of conditions.
Well, I'm not an attorney, but I would bet money that there are going to be many civil rights lawsuits that are filed from this period that will be successful.
Have media had access? So we know that there is a, you know, this sort of, you know, potentially staged, freshly painted tour for the mayor. But, you know, part of the way that we manage to ensure that our elected leaders and our institutions are doing what the law says is we shine the bright light of media on them. Do reporters have access into Rikers, and acknowledging that it's the COVID period?
We have not sort of gotten like a tour of Rikers in the way that like the mayor and some elected officials have gotten to sort of see, you know, wander the halls, talk to detainees, talk to staff, hear for ourselves how it's been. However, you know, reporters like myself covering this issue have spoken to people who are recently incarcerated, staff members who are currently there. And there was a press conference that was held at Rikers Island in which the Department of Correction Commissioner here in New York basically begged staff to come back to work to try to help the jails run better. So to some extent, yes, but of course, jails are a much more isolated institution than other institutions in society. But that's especially the case in New York, where our biggest jail complex, Rikers Island, is on an island separated from the rest of the city. There's a bridge to go in and there's a bridge to go out. You can only visit on certain days. You need to have permissions to get in. You have to sort of give your press credentials beforehand, and you can't sort of just proactively call someone. You have to wait for them to call you. So the sort of information flow is not ideal, certainly.
Talk to me about policy reforms. What is possible? Maybe what other states, not that jail is a happy and highly functioning place really in any of the 50 American states, but are there other states where advocates are moving so that conditions don't look like this?
So how to fix or address the solution is a very political question right now. In New York City, we have sort of two sides where one coalition of advocates who sort of represent corrections officers are pushing for more hires. They want to improve the ratio of staff to incarcerated people, arguing that that way their members won't have to work double and triple shifts and be sort of overstressed and overstretched and unable to meet basic needs. However, that federal monitor who I referenced earlier, who's overseeing the city jails, he has found that New York actually has a higher ratio of staff to detainees than most other comparable jail systems across the country. And his argument is, look, DOC is not using the staff they have properly, not putting enough of them in detainee-facing roles to where, you know, they're actually using their staff efficiently to get people their basic services. So he doesn't think the problem is one of staffing. He thinks it's one of sort of management and resource allocation. And then on the other hand, or on the other side, you have the sort of criminal justice reform advocates who sort of inspired by the Black Lives Matter defund movement in some ways are arguing that you need to reduce the jail population, that that is a better way to improve the staff ratio by sending fewer people to jail in the first place, so that with the few people that you have there, you can ensure that they sort of get treated with dignity and get basic resources. Right now, the mayor has sort of leaned more to the former solution. He's promised to hire some more guards. A new class of recruits is coming in. The city is attempting to recruit older guards who can come in from retirement on a faster basis. But it's not the amount that the corrections officers union has called for. And at the same time, as we've mentioned at the top of the show, Governor Hochul has moved in some slight ways towards decarceration, releasing about 200 people from city jails and moving some others to state facilities. But it's not the sort of major chunk that would ultimately change that ratio.
As you talk about the politics involved, obviously, New York City has an election happening next month. Is it possible that the results of that election can affect the future of the city's jails?
That really remains to be seen. The person who is expected to become the next mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, a Democrat, has promised to continue with the de Blasio, Mayor de Blasio, our current mayor's vision of closing the jails, closing Rikers, rather. However, that would be contingent on getting the jail population down to sort of pre-pandemic levels and even a bit lower. How he's going to do that is unclear because he hasn't articulated a vision for doing so. Similarly, he has expressed some concerns about what the mayor's plans are to close Rikers and replace it with borough-based jails. So things are really up in the air right now, and this is a major question mark in New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio's legacy, because he has long sort of rested on the achievement of having closed Rikers in the future. Mm-hmm. And now that future is uncertain.
So you and the On the Media producer, Michael Loewinger, recently broke some news after reviewing documents that indicated that there are current and former New York City law enforcement officers with ties to the Oath Keepers, which is a far-right extremist group. Can you just say a bit about that reporting?
Sure. So last week, a hacker breached into the servers of this extremist anti-government group, the Oath Keepers, which had some of its members linked to the Capitol riots or insurrection on January 6th. And when that hacker got those documents and records, he or she, we're not sure who the person is, gave them to an internet transparency collective, which publishes sort of hacked records like this. They posted the documents online And my co-reporter and I, Michael Lowinger, started going through, combing through the records. And particularly, we were interested in, are there current or former members of law enforcement in the military that are shown to be members of the Oath Keepers? Because this group has long sort of prided itself on having that sort of tactical military-like prowess. And, you know, for those who remember seeing some of the people who were accused of storming the Capitol as part of the Oath Keepers, they were wearing sort of camo military-looking stuff alongside having the Oath Keepers symbol. So when we went through these records, and there are hundreds of them for people in New York and thousands of them for people across the country, we did find that there were several active and former law enforcement personnel in them, at least the same names. Unfortunately, when we called those people, they declined to sort of confirm their status as sort of active members of the Oath Keepers right now. But we did sort of find matching names, not only to police officers who are on the force today in New York City and across the state, but also corrections officers, jail guards, current and former in some cases. So quite a spectrum here in New York State.
Do you see a main takeaway from that reporting? It's pretty jaw-dropping.
I would say the takeaway is that this issue of far-right infiltration has been on people's minds for quite a while. And what our elected officials are willing to do about this, how much they're willing to confront this issue is still unclear. When we presented our findings, the mayor's office promised an immediate investigation, but also said later at a press conference, Mayor de Blasio said that a sort of full department-wide audit of the NYPD was not necessary. He likened such a search for extremist ties to a sort of McCarthyite witch hunt. And at the gubernatorial level, it's unclear to us what the governor is sort of willing to do on that side of things, whether she would do a sort of more broad, comprehensive search beyond our initial findings is unclear, because you've got to think that there are some people who didn't have their names in membership logs, but have these sorts of affiliations, perhaps more covertly. So are we sort of, as a government, actually addressing this? That's one of the questions I have from this.
George Joseph, law enforcement reporter for WNYC. Thank you for all of your reporting.
Thanks for having me. This was fun.
Now, are you up for playing a little game? I promise it's nothing too strenuous. I'm going to say a word. Let a picture form in your mind. No judgment. Just notice the picture that appears for you. Okay, ready? First word, scientist. What did you see? Now, if your mind delivered a man, maybe wearing glasses in a lab, you know, working on something like a big old chemistry set, well, then you're like the majority of Americans.
It's alive! It's alive! It's alive!
Okay, next word. Athlete. What did you see? Now, was your mental picture something like NFL Sports Sunday? Because if it is, then hey, you're like most people. All right, last word. Political leader. Again, what did you see? Was it a tall man standing behind a podium giving a speech? If so, again, you're just like most of us. And by now, you've likely noticed something. These words, scientist, athlete, political leader, they're all broad, gender-neutral terms, but they tend to evoke narrow, gender-specific mental pictures. Jane Goodall, observing gorillas, is as much a scientist as a white-coated male chemist. Simone Biles is as much an athlete as the college men of March Madness. And Nancy Pelosi is every bit a political leader as the 45 men who've occupied the White House since our founding. But far too often, the images we see in the world around us reinforce a gendered vision of the political world. So we asked you what the words political leader evoked. And here's what you told us.
These days, I want my political leaders to be 20 years younger, female, and less white. They should be well-educated in civics and politics and demonstrate involvement in their constituent communities. My name is Tom Kate, and I live in Sacramento, California.
I would like a leader like Joe Biden, if not Joe Biden, to lead this country. You know, we need men of courage. My name is John. I'm from East Hampton, New York.
Hi, this is Julie Terry from Ashland, Kentucky. And the ones that come to my mind actually are all female. I'm thinking of Katie Porter. I'm thinking of Amy Klobuchar, Elizabeth Warren, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. They speak the way people can understand, and not in this political speak, but they speak plainly in common, plain language. And they talk about issues that people really care about.
Hi, this is Ed Lance from downtown Los Angeles. I would like to describe my ideal political leader. That would be someone who is devoted to service and acting in the best interest of all parties involved. Not in it for the money. Doesn't have to be an angel. They say a dirty word or something, we're not going to throw them out. We are looking to them for their service.
When I imagine a political leader, I want to imagine the exact opposite of Mitch McConnell. I imagine someone who puts people before power, can actually make a compromise, and helps the government work, and doesn't stop it dead in its tracks just because they don't like the way things are going.
This is Melanie from Macedonia, Ohio. I think of a political leader as somebody with a bad haircut and nice teeth.
For just a moment, I want you to sit down, settle in, and get ready for a little story time with MHP. I'm going to read to you from one of my favorite books, Grace for President. It's written by Kelly DiPuccio. And Grace, the main character, is a little black girl. She's attending the fictional Woodrow Wilson Elementary School. And here's how the book begins. One Monday morning in September, Mrs. Barrington rolled out a big poster with all the president's pictures on it. Grace Campbell could not believe her eyes. Where are all the girls? That's a very good question, said Mrs. Barrington. The truth is, our country has never had a woman president. No girl president ever? Asked Grace. I'm afraid not, said Mrs. Barrington. Grace sat at her desk and stewed. No girls? Who'd ever heard of such a crazy thing? Okay, I'm going to stop here, but I do encourage all of you to find and finish this book because Grace decides to run for president of her school. And it turns out she's a hardworking idealist who is not easily deterred. Mrs. Barrington is one great teacher, and just wait until you meet Thomas Cobb and Wyoming Sam. But for at least a decade, I've been gifting Grace for President to young girls and to their parents in hopes that these daughters will be able to see past the presidential posters showing only boys and find a way to see themselves in American democracy. New research published in the American Political Science Review last month suggests that gendered political socialization is a powerful force, deterring many girls from pursuing the possibility of a political life. And for more on this, we're joined now by Zoe Oxley, who's professor of political science at Union College. Zoe, it is lovely to have you here.
Thanks so much, Melissa. I look forward to talking to you.
So what exactly is gendered political socialization?
So gendered political socialization is really an intermingling of two types of socialization that children are exposed to. On the one hand, through the process of gender socialization, children learn which adult roles are typically held by women, such as caregiving roles, nurturing roles, and which roles are typically held by men, such as managers or leadership roles. Gender socialization also teaches children which traits women and girls are expected to possess and which traits boys and men are expected to possess. So at the same time gender socialization is happening, kids are also learning about the political world. The process of political socialization exposes children to government and politics, including, as Grace does in the book that you just read from, including kids learn who have been political leaders in the past, and by omission, who haven't been leaders in the past. Kids also learn about governmental structures through the media, through school curricula. They learn about what activities take place in the political world. My colleagues and I argue that these two streams come together to produce gendered political socialization. So children learn that politics has been in the past and actually still is today dominated by men. They also learn that the political world is quite masculine, values competition, assertiveness, and less often in the political world do we see traits of compassion, nurturance, and those traits that girls are socialized to think that they need to possess. So from a variety of sources, individuals as well as mass media and other sources, girls really receive the message that politics is not a domain for them, that politics is really for boys and for men.
And when does this gendered political socialization begin? Or perhaps it begins at the beginning, but when do we begin to really see its effects?
So gender socialization actually happens very, very young. And scholars have long documented from infants and toddlers picking certain toys to play with, certain activities to engage with. Political socialization more likely starts in elementary school. That's certainly when children get exposed through their social studies classes from their teachers about political history. But children are also exposed through the media, through conversations with their parents, depending upon the political interest and activity level of the household.
How does all this fit with the current sort of numeric underrepresentation of women in elected office? Are you thinking there's a direct line of causality that maybe whatever is causing one is also causing the other? What is your at least hunch about how they connect?
My colleagues and I have long been interested in women's underrepresentation in political office and have worked on research in the past trying to understand why. We know from past scholarship that adolescent boys and girls are already showing distinct levels of interest in politics generally, but also a desire maybe to have a political job in the future. So we wondered whether young children as well show varying levels of interest in politics. So the project that we undertook, at one of the goals was to examine whether girls and boys do show, again, different levels of interest in politics and different levels of curiosity really about learning about politics and government. We uncovered that kids as young as around 10 years old, we start to see a divergence with girls being less interested than boys in the political domain. Actually, at a younger age, or at around age 6, there really aren't that differences between boys and girls. But as girls age between 6 and 12, they steadily decline in their level of curiosity and excitement about politics, whereas boys' interest stays relatively level. We also asked children, these were kids in grades 1 through 6, we asked them what kind of jobs they might like to hold in the future. Among those jobs listed were some political jobs like president, governor, judge. And we find there as well that girls show a steady decrease in interest in any of the political jobs as they age from about age 6 to about age 12. At every age, boys were more interested in these political careers than were girls, but the gap widened as these children aged up through grade 6.
Now, I am fascinated by one particular aspect of how you studied this gendered political socialization. Can you tell me about the DAPL, the Draw a Political Leader task?
When we were designing our study, we drew pretty heavily from research in science, technology, engineering, and math. These STEM fields have, for decades now, asked kids to do a drawing task called Draw a Scientist, where the children were asked to envision what they think a scientist looks like and then draw what they envisioned. What we did was adopt this task, which we call the Draw a Political Leader task, but very similarly, we asked kids to shut their eyes and think about what a political leader looks like. And then we gave them a piece of paper and some crayons and asked them to draw what they had envisioned. We also asked them a few pretty brief follow-up questions to get some more information about what they had in mind. We collected these drawings from about 1,600 elementary school kids from 4 different research sites across the country. we coded them then. In particular, we wanted to know whether kids drew men or women as political leaders. And what we find is that among these age groups, all children, boys and girls, were more likely to draw men. But the more interesting and perhaps disturbing finding, if you're believing that politics should be a domain for girls, as girls grew older, they were more likely to draw men than when they were younger. So put another way, when they're around 6 years of age, girls were less likely to draw men than boys were. But by age 10, the girls and the boys were equally likely to draw men because girls had changed their visions of what a political leader is and were more likely to envision political leadership as being really the domain of men.
I'm wondering, since there is this increasing separation of girls from interest and from their own sense of being representative of political leaders, that gets worse as they get older. I'm wondering if we see in school leadership positions a similar gap. So are girls less likely to run for president of the senior class? Are they less likely to run for class senator in college? Or if this really tends to manifest in our adult political world?
It certainly manifests most strongly in the adult political world. At the high school level, some other research that I'm familiar with has found that girls actually are quite likely to run for student council or student class presidents, other kind of student government offices in high school. But by college, we start to see girls being less interested in running for student government. So there's something about this, you know, switch from high school to college that sends a message to girls and young women that leadership, government leadership at their colleges and universities, but then also out in the political domain, isn't a place for them.
So how can all of us be more like Mrs. Barrington and actually nurture and boost the political interest and ambition of the girls in our classrooms, in our households, and in our lives?
I think a few things might be useful. Certainly school curricula, so those of us who are teachers, school curricula could be diversified to give exposed children, boys and girls, to examples of women who have been leaders in the past. So to the degree that a school curricula focuses on U.S. history of leadership only on presidents, right, then there's only male examples. But there are certainly lots of other kinds of leaders in the politics as well as in government that have been women. Also, school curricula could emphasize the diversity and kinds of leadership traits that are valued in politics and more broadly in our society. So moving away from this notion that masculine traits of assertiveness and aggression and things of that nature are what we would expect in the political domain. So starting to present a different picture to kids, both of who leaders can be and how leaders can behave, I think would be useful. In terms of those of us who aren't teachers, but even in our other parts of our lives, certainly showing kids examples of leadership in many different domains, boys and girls, but maybe especially girls, emphasizing leadership skills that they may be building elsewhere, whether it be in some clubs and activities or in their neighborhoods or just among their friend group, and discussing how those can be translated into the world of politics. Those are some, I think, steps that we could all take individually. But, you know, at the end, it is important to recognize that the processes of gender socialization and what we call gendered political socialization are pretty strong.
Zoe Oxley is professor of political science at Union College. Professor Oxley, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And if the Freedom Democratic Party is not seated now, I question America. Is this America, the land of the free and the home of the brave, where we have to sleep with our telephones off of the hook because our lives be threatened daily, because we want to live as decent human beings in America? Thank you.
That was the voice of Fannie Lou Hamer testifying before the Credentials Committee at the Democratic National Convention in 1964. During her testimony, Fannie Lou Hamer spoke of being brutally beaten by Mississippi jail officials simply for trying to register to vote. Now, Hamer was an impoverished sharecropper with no formal education, but her powerful message was so threatening to the established racial and political order that President Lyndon Johnson preempted the televised testimony with an impromptu press conference about a minor issue. Later that night, though, the networks broadcast Hamer's entire testimony during prime time. And although the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party did not win a seat at the convention that year, Hamer's words and her continuing years of activism transformed representation within the Democratic Party. For more on the legacy of Fannie Lou Hamer, I spoke with Dr. Keisha Blaine, author of the new book, Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. And Professor Blaine started by telling me a bit about who Fannie Lou Hamer was.
Fannie Lou Hamer was a courageous civil rights activist, also a human rights activist, who advocated for Black political rights in the United States during the 1960s. And I think most people know her in the context of the 1964 Democratic National Convention, where she gave a passionate speech about state-sanctioned violence, voter suppression, and several other pressing concerns which challenged the nation.
Say a bit more about that speech, because it is often slightly quoted, misquoted, the quotes are taken out of context, but it was so powerful, right, that it shook a president. It terrified Lyndon Johnson even.
It did. It was a powerful, moving speech. And she spoke about the challenges that she faced as a Black woman living in Mississippi. She spoke about the violence. She spoke about the difficulties with casting a ballot. She really pointed out the problems with American society and underscored that it was not a place of equal opportunity. And she demanded changes.
Talk to me about how Mississippi shaped Fannie Lou Hamer.
Hamer, like so many others, grew up in a sharecropping family. And this certainly shaped her experiences, having to live in poverty, having to constantly be relying on white people, on white planters, in the case of sharecropping, for her daily sustenance. And it was a violent place. Most people certainly know about the Emmett Till case. Having interactions, day-to-day interactions, could lead to a violent attack, certainly lynching. So Mississippi was a very tough place to be, and certainly as an organizer in the 60s in particular.
Talk about the Freedom Farm Cooperative. It is certainly not completely unique, but it does certainly stand out as part of what designates her work as quite different than the kind of integrationists in public accommodations work, again, that we tend to associate with the civil rights movement.
Because she endured hunger and poverty in her life, she wanted to make sure that she created a space where others in need would have the basic necessities. And so she launched in the late 1960s, Freedom Farm. It was a collective. It was an opportunity for people to grow crops, to sustain themselves, to certainly to work, even to live. It became this vibrant community, which not only provided resources for people in the Mississippi Delta, but even extended beyond the area.
I want to read this one piece because I paused on it and have been reflecting on it since I read this. And this is in a segment that you call I'm Tired of Being Called Auntie. And you write that in the early 1960s, Hamer publicly addressed the disrespect she and other Black women faced in a society that devalued the lives and contributions of Black people. She, being Hamer, pointed to the common practice of white people referring to her as girl and auntie, terms that failed to recognize Hamer's personhood. Those two words, girl and auntie, can be words of such loving endearment when spoken by other Black women to Black women. But reading them here and thinking of what they sound like in the voices of white segregationists, I was hoping maybe you could walk us through a little bit about both the reclamation of those terms and what Hamer is saying in this moment about womanhood and Black womanhood.
So in the context of Mississippi in the 1960s, these were terms that were meant to demean Black women. And Hamer wanted to call attention to that as part of a larger project of her commitment to women's empowerment, certainly, and as part of the genealogy of Black feminist thought, even though, as I explained in the book, Hamer did not identify as a feminist.
She did experience specific gender-based violence, both in the context of sexual violence and in the context of reproductive violence. Can you say a few words about that?
She was the victim of a forced sterilization, and this was a situation where she had been hospitalized to remove a small uterine tumor. This was a non-cancerous tumor, and without her knowledge, the white physician decided to remove her uterus. She found out about it after the procedure in the most demeaning way. She found out through gossip. People were whispering about it. And, you know, she confronted the doctor, certainly angry about what had taken place. And she was unable to get any kind of response or compassion from him. But it set her on a path to speak boldly about forced sterilization, to talk about the exploitation, the violence that Black women were facing in that particular context. And then just 2 years later, in 63, she experienced a brutal beating in Winona, Mississippi, and a sexual assault as well in a jail cell. So she just endured so many painful experiences. But everything that she went through strengthened her, as difficult as that sounds, and gave her, I think, even clarity about her mission to improve the lives of everyone around her.
The subtitle of the book is Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America. For you, what is Fannie Lou Hamer's enduring message to America?
I think Hamer's message to America can really be encapsulated in the title, which is Until I Am Free. As Hamer traveled throughout the United States in the 1960s, she would often say, whether you are Black or white, you are not free until I am free either. And I think that message is an important one. It's a reminder that we are all connected, regardless of our differences. We are connected as part of this American polity. And that means that we have to be concerned about the experiences of other people. We have to be committed to the liberation of all groups. That's the message to America.
Keisha Blaine's Until I Am Free, Fannie Lou Hamer's Enduring Message to America, has a publication date of October 5th. Fannie Lou Hamer's birthday is October 6th. Dr. Keisha Blaine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, everybody, that's the show for today. Now I'm still here in New York City enjoying the drizzly fall weather and getting to work in person with Team Takeaway. So if you see me out and about in the city, be sure to say hi. And of course, call us with your show ideas or suggestions at 877-8-MY-TAKE. That's 877-869-8253. Or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and this is The Takeaway.